This is VOA News via remote.
I'm Laurel Bowman. Russian President Vladimir Putin told his Finnish counterpart Sauli Niinistö on Saturday that ditching neutrality and joining NATO would be a mistake that could damage relations between their two countries, the Kremlin said. The two countries said their presidents spoke by phone 2 days after Finland declared its intention to join the Western alliance. Moscow has described that as a security threat that will require it to respond, but the Kremlin has not specified how. Very complex talks are underway to evacuate a large number of wounded soldiers from a besieged steelworks in the strategic southeastern port of Mariupol in return for the release of Russian prisoners of war. This is what Ukraine's president is saying. Mariupol, which has seen the heaviest fighting in nearly 3 months of war, is now in Russian hands, but hundreds of Ukrainian defenders are still holding out at the Azovstal steelworks despite weeks of heavy Russian bombardment. Group of seven foreign ministers vowed on Saturday to reinforce Russia's economic and political isolation as well as continue supplying weapons to Ukraine. Diplomats from Britain, Canada, Germany, France, Italy, Japan, the United States, and the European Union also pledged to continue their military and defense assistance to Ukraine for as long as necessary. And a Ukrainian court has held a preliminary hearing in the first war crimes trial arising from Russia's February 24th invasion after charging a captured Russian soldier with the murder of a 62-year-old civilian. The Kyiv government has accused Russia of atrocities and brutality against civilians during the invasion and said it has identified more than 10,000 possible war crimes. Russia denies the charges. This is VOA News. Police in Somalia have announced a 33-hour curfew on the capital Mogadishu that will keep almost all residents at home during a presidential election by lawmakers on Sunday, in which incumbent leader Mohamed Abdullahi Mohamed is seeking a second term. A police spokesperson announced at a press conference on Saturday a full curfew in the city covering both traffic and people from Saturday at 9 p.m. until Monday at 6 a.m. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un said on Saturday the spread of COVID-19 had thrust his country into great turmoil and called for an all-out battle to overcome the outbreak. This as 21 daily deaths were reported among people with fever. North Korea this week acknowledged for the first time a COVID-19 outbreak, imposing a national lockdown, but there was no sign of a rigorous testing or treatment campaign in the isolated country's healthcare system. Police in New Delhi, India, arrested two people suspected of flouting fire safety regulations on Saturday after at least 27 people died in a blaze at a building housing a manufacturing unit for surveillance cameras. Rescue teams worked overnight to clear the burnout four-story building near a railway station in the western suburbs. The Palestinian Authority said on Saturday it would welcome international support in the inquiry into the death of an Al Jazeera journalist, while Israel said it would investigate an eruption of violence at her funeral. The death of veteran reporter Shireen Abu Akleh sparked an outpouring of grief, and Israeli police charged at a crowd of Palestinian mourners carrying her coffin through Jerusalem's Old City on Friday, which drew international condemnation. United Arab Emirates strongman Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan was formally elected president on Saturday. Among his past endeavors are these. He led a realignment of the Middle East that created a new anti-Iran axis with Israel and fought a rising tide of political Islam in the region. And working behind the scenes for years as de facto leader, Sheikh Mohammed transformed the UAE's military into a high-tech force, which, coupled with its oil wealth and business hub status, extended Emirati influence internationally. And India banned wheat exports on Saturday as a scorching heat wave curtailed output and domestic prices hit a record high. For more on these and other stories making news today, please visit our website at voanews.com. Via remote, I'm Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
We must rededicate ourselves to make sure that the Namibian people are treated equally, and also the economic dividends of our natural domain are benefiting all the Namibian people. That is what we should do.
Namibia celebrates the birthday of its founding and first president, Sam Nujoma.
So ASUU is trying to resolve this problem. So as I speak with you, we don't have any good public primary secondary school. They killed it. And they want to do exactly the same thing to the university, and we will not allow it. As the body of intellectuals, we will not allow it.
Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari appeals to the Academic Staff Union of Universities to call off its ongoing strike.
People affected from the explosions in Badab, Theodorini is not talking about that. Theodorini is talking about focusing solely on what can help me get elected in next year when I present myself as the candidate. That is Theodorini's concern.
And the authorities in Equatorial Guinea launches a security operation to crack down on criminal gangs. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Namibia, Dr. Sam Nujoma, the founding father and first president of the Southern African country, celebrated his 93rd birthday on Thursday. It was a low-key event at his home in the capital, Windhoek. The ruling party, the Southwest Africa People's Organization, or SWAPO, congratulated the former president on his birthday. The party described him as one of the strongest pillars of wisdom and said it was grateful for Nujoma's fruitful life and for his dedication to the fight for Namibia's independence. For more reaction, I reached Nahas Angula. He is the chairman of the Sam Nujoma Foundation.
Dr. Sam Nujoma was designated by the Parliament of Namibia as the father of the Namibian nation, and was also accorded a title by the SWAPO party as the leader of the Namibian Revolution.
Why? Why was this done?
Yes, that was done because Sam Nujoma, given his very humble background, born in a village looking after cattle, eventually he went to urban areas, and during the urban area, during his stay there, he saw the injustice being perpetrated against the indigenous people of Namibia. He decided that these injustices must be brought to an end. That's why he joined other nationalists in Namibia, like the chief of the Herero, who was petitioning the United Nations to make sure that Namibia is no more a vassal of South Africa. This didn't work out. So the SWAPO party was founded to mobilize the Namibian people and to fight for freedom and justice.
Did the fight for freedom and justice that led to Namibia's independence? Did the founding president demonstrate that during his presidency?
Yes, he did. He made sure that a number of social programs were put in place to assist the poor and the elders. If you look at Namibian social protection programs, you will see that Namibia spends a lot of money to support the elders, the disabled, children, and other people who are in distress. I hope that you Google Namibian protection system and you will see how much the Namibian government is spending on the people of Namibia to make sure that there is social justice in Namibia.
What lessons should Namibians learn on this special day when the country celebrates the 93rd birthday of founding president Dr. Sam Nujoma?
What we are learning, or what we are dedicating ourselves to, is to follow the footsteps of Dr. Sam Nujoma and dedicate our lives and commitment to the welfare and improvement of the well-being of the Namibian people. We know that Namibia is one of the countries with high level of unique coefficients, inequality, unemployment, and poverty. We must rededicate ourselves to make sure that the Namibian people are treated equally, and also the economic dividends of our natural endowments are benefiting all the Namibian people. That is what we should do.
Nahas Angula is the chairman of the Sam Nujoma Foundation. He spoke with me from the Namibian capital, Windhoek. Nigeria's President Muhammadu Buhari is appealing to the Academic Staff Union of Universities to call off its ongoing strike. The president says the group should consider the plight of students, rescind their decision and return to the classroom. His appeal comes after university staff announced they were extending their strike for 12 more weeks. The decision followed a meeting by the National Executive Committee in the capital, Abuja. The strike extension will give the government enough time to, in the group's words, satisfactorily resolve all outstanding issues. Their key demands include the revitalization of and increased funding for all public universities, as well as the payment of promotion arrears and allowances. For reaction to the president's appeal, I reached Professor Emmanuel Oshodeke. He is the president of the Academic Staff Universities, or ASU.
We started the strike on February 14th. That was the initial 4 weeks. At the end of the 4 weeks, they didn't do much. They didn't do anything. So we extended it by 8 weeks to hoping that within 8 weeks, they will meet with us and resolve all the issues. But at the end of the 8 weeks, the team did not do anything. So we now have extended it by 12 weeks to give them enough time to do what they should do.
I understand the president constituted a panel to negotiate with ASU to resolve your concerns. What came out of it?
We've not met with that panel. They've not invited for any meeting. Today is the crisis we're having here. They are not serious about any of these issues. This agreement we asked to negotiate was signed in 2009 with the provision that every 3 years it will be reviewed. Now it is 11 years and they have not agreed to review it. They set up the whole panel in 2017. And we also set our own, we started meeting. It took 4 years for us to reach an agreement. A draft agreement was produced. They were going to take it to the principal, which is the government, to give the permission to sign. We also took it to our member to give our permission to sign. But from that time, May 2021, today, they are not reverted back to us. Those are the critical issues that we're having that are creating all the problem, and they are ready to resolve the problem.
Are you saying negotiations with the government to resolve your concerns have stalled or not moving forward?
It has stalled. It's not moving. They have not come back to us.
So where does things stand now? Because students are being affected. They are staying home. Nigeria will lose as a result of what is happening. These are concerns by parents that are here in Nigeria. So where do things stand now?
You see, I think what should concern the parents from our own side, is the quality of education that their children are having. All those who are in charge of our education all over the place, their children are not in Nigerian universities. If they believe that Nigerian universities are all good, why are they sending their children abroad? Why are they, if they know it is good, it is okay, why wouldn't they put their children in these universities? There are a lot of the children of the ordinary person who cannot afford it to suffer in the university that they're not funding, why they need to go and spend so much money abroad, including USA. We have no less than 10,000 Nigerian students in USA. So our children are brought to go and study instead of putting in Nigerian universities. So that is our crisis. So the parents, the students, all of us, should be thinking about our country. If we are patriotic, we should develop our own, allow our children to be here, also allow children from other countries to come to Nigeria to study. That is the idea of a university.
But Professor Oshodeke, what do you say to critics of your organization who are of the view that they take their children abroad because as you embark on indefinite strikes that undermine the very education it says it wants to protect?
Have you been to Nigerian universities? What did you see? Are they as good as the one you have in the U.S.? Good, too. What is the average level of a professor in the U.S.? In Nigeria, it's $600. Therefore, can you have lecturers coming from all over the world to teach in Nigeria? A university is a place where lecturers from all over the world come to teach. We students from all over the world come to take knowledge. It's not a Nigeria, it's not a local issue. And you know that what happened in the U.S., what happened where you are. What are we having the opposite here? If the university are well run, they will not be strike. In the 60s, 70s,
We didn't have problems with universities. And we have in my department where I school, we have five foreigners teaching that university. My professor was from Sierra Leone. So do you still have such thing? So today, strike is a symptom, not a problem. And we should not be trying to justify that strike is the problem.
So what's the next line of action for ASUU in this ongoing stalemate between yourself and the government to resolve your concerns?
We are waiting for them. Whenever they are ready, we are also ready. But we are waiting to bring back the question how it was in the old days, we will be ready. Let me give you an example. In the 70s, 1670, the Western region were giving almost 30% of their budget to education. Even in Ghana, our neighbor, where our students are going today, they are giving up to 16 to 20% to education. South Africa, the same thing. Nigeria, 5.4%. How can a country devote 5.4% of the budget to education and keep your heart below? You wouldn't have a problem. Is there any country in the world that is giving 5.4% of the budget to education? There is a crisis. So ASUU is trying to resolve this problem. Today, as I speak with you, you don't have any good public primary secondary school. They killed it. And they want to do exactly the same to the university and we will not allow it. As the body of intellectuals, we will not allow it.
Professor Emmanuel Oshodeke is the president of the Academic Staff of Universities, or ASUU. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Religious groups and rights activists in Nigeria are calling for justice after a female Christian student was killed by a mob for alleged blasphemy. The student was beaten and burned to death on the premises of a school in northwestern Sokoto State. For VOA, Timothy Obiezo reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
The Catholic Diocese of Sokoto criticized the attack in a statement Friday and called on state authorities to catch and prosecute the killers. Rights groups like Amnesty International and the Socioeconomic Rights Accountability Project, or SERAP, have also condemned the attack and are demanding justice for the student. Police say two people have so far been arrested in connection with the incident and that they're searching for others who took part in the killing. The incident took place at the Shehu Shagari College of Education in Sokoto State. A mob of students flogged, stoned, and eventually burned Deborah Yakubu to death near the school Thursday. The students accused Yakubu of making blasphemous statements about the Muslim prophet Muhammad during an online argument with classmates. The argument took place during the Muslim Ramadan holiday, but when school resumed Thursday, a group of students attacked Yakubu. Sheung Bakari is an Amnesty International spokesperson.
It is not only sad, but deeply disturbing, because this is not the first time that things like this continue to happen, and we have called for thorough and an impartial investigation into what truly transpired. And we are hoping that the perpetrators will be brought to book so that it can serve as a deterrent.
The Christian Association of Nigeria blames authorities for failing to prevent the attack. Sokoto State authorities have shut down the school indefinitely. Under Nigeria's secular law, blasphemy is punishable by up to 2 years in prison. But in the more conservative northern region where religious or Sharia law is favored, blasphemy is often treated with stiffer punishments, including a possible death sentence. Last month, a court in northern Kano State sentenced the Nigerian effaced to 24 years in prison for blasphemy. Bakari says both the secular and Sharia laws flout international human rights standards.
When compared to international human rights law, none of these laws can stand, because international human rights law guarantees the freedom of expression, and Nigeria is a state party to other international standards that uphold the freedom of expression.
Last November, the U.S. government removed Nigeria from its list of countries that violate religious freedom. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
The authorities in Equatorial Guinea have launched a security operation aimed at cracking down on criminal gangs. They have also imposed a curfew from 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. for all young people who are 18 years or younger. The move follows reports of members of the gangs terrorizing the public. They are accused of carrying out acts of violence and robbery since the beginning of the year. But critics say the crackdown is a calculated plan to boost the presidential prospects of Vice President Teodoro Nguema Obiang-Mangu. is the son of the president, is reported to be the successor to his aging father. But supporters of the government say the authorities must act to protect life and property as enshrined in the Constitution. For reaction, I reach Tutu Alicante. He is the executive director of the civil society group called Equatorial Guinea Justice.
There are elections coming up. We have parliamentary elections at some point in this year. We are right now in May. We still do not know. The government has not announced a date. We have presidential elections coming up. And in light of those elections coming up, Teodorin is now putting in place a diversion tactic so that people will believe that he's actually doing something to help society. He is out there sending all these armed military men. I have the pictures, I have the videos, and you can see the way they are treating young people in the streets, and it's deplorable. That is the problem we have. What we have is the military finding an excuse over here to brutalize the population, create enough fear in this population, and create the perception that Teodorin cares about something, and he becomes more presidentiable next year.
The government is saying that the gendarmerie, the police, and other security operatives have been put on alert to crack down on these violence carried out by these gangs terrorizing people since the beginning of the year. Supporters of the government are saying it is the duty of the government to protect life and property as enshrined in the Equatorial Guinean Constitution. And they are just doing that.
The Prime Minister of Equatorial Guinea, Mr. Pascual Obama, has had a campaign going to the streets, destroying people's homes, because they're trying to build hotels and whatever it is that they have in mind. Nobody's doing anything about that, and that's vandalizing and destroying property of people in that country. Now you have young people who, as I mentioned, have been deprived of education and are out in the street trying to find a way to survive. And this is, we're not talking about a situation where you have armed young people. You're talking about a situation of young people in the street stealing people's phones to make an end, to make a living, right? Make ends meet. This is what you have. Now, the government, as I mentioned earlier, is using this as a diversion technique, right? Diversion tactic to keep people's mind away from the fact that since COVID, multiple families do not have a job or where to feed themselves and have to struggle, right? And this is what the government is responding to. There is no situation of gangs. I have people living in Equatorial. My own sisters live in Equatorial Guinea. And in light of all this government rhetoric, I've called my own sister and said, look, the situation here in my own neighborhood has not changed from last year to this year. Do we have young people trying to steal your phone? Yes, we had that last year. We had that the previous year. So nothing has changed in Equatorial Guinea from the previous year.
Teodorin is saying that they are listening to people who are complaining about the youth who are in the streets and they are delinquents and they are attacking people, and that he has taken a decision, a firm decision, to ensure that the people are protected and their property is protected. This is what supporters of the government are saying he's supposed to do as a leading member of the government or the vice president of the government, despite the fact that his father has been the president or remains the president.
So the day we start taking what Teodorin says about the problems in Equatorial Guinea as the fact or as legitimately what's happening in Equatorial Guinea, we have made a huge mistake. We have a problem in Equatorial Guinea of multiple people, thousands of people languishing in jails without due process. Teodorin is not talking about that. We have a problem of thousands of families who have lost family members, poor in the streets. Teodorin is not talking about that. People affected from the explosions in Badab. Teodorin is not talking about that. Teodorin is talking about focusing solely on what can help me get elected in next year when I present myself as the candidate. That is Teodorin's concern.
Tutu Alicante is the executive director of the civil society group called Equatorial Guinea Justice. He spoke with me from here in the U.S. In Uganda, the political pressure group called the People's Front for Transition, also known as the Red Card Front, says police are blocking its leader, Dr. Kizza Besigye, from leaving his home. They prevented Dr. Besigye, a former opposition presidential candidate, from attending a demonstration. The anti-government protest, his group says, was against the sharp rise in the price of goods and services in the East African country. The police say Besigye's planned protest violates the Public Order Management Act and would also have created chaos if it had been allowed to proceed, an assertion the Red Card Front denies. Michael Mabike is the general secretary of the Red Card Front. He tells me that the action of the police contravenes the Ugandan constitution, which guarantees freedom of expression and assembly.
Dr. Besigye yesterday was engaged in an act of protest. He was actually protesting against skyrocketing prices. It is unfortunate that the police used a lot of force, brute force actually, to arrest him. And once arrested, they took him back to his home where he has been held under house arrest to death. Many leaders have tried to access him today, but they have been held out of his home by police, which is still there till now.
Michael, some people are suggesting that his protest, usually in marketplaces, inconveniences people and brings commerce to a halt when he does that because of the throng of people causing people's livelihoods to be lost by such protests. And that is why the police would have to act in order to prevent such chaos. How do you respond to that?
It's a false excuse used by police to hold back pro-democracy activists. As you know, the right to demonstrate, the right to assemble, and the right to associate are guaranteed by the Constitution of the Republic of Uganda. But when you find police and security agencies actually violating those provisions of the mother law, the Republic of Uganda, it is worrying. And of course, it amounts to abuse of the Constitution and disregard of the constitutional order and rule of law of Uganda. Dr. Besigye was not arrested in the market. He was arrested in a road, a main road, heading to Kampala. He was not heading to a market. He was not heading to a business center. He was actually walking innocently and armed on his way to Kampala. So it is not true, and it is indeed false, that the police would actually use propaganda to try and demonize and also mislead that activists actually conduct their activities in markets and business premises. That's not right. Even if this act were to be conducted in an open space, a playground, a stadium, still it would not be allowed by the powers that be.
But Michael Mabike, President Museveni is on record to have told VOA that there are places where you hold the National Day Parade, where it wouldn't affect businesses or traffic, and that those are places where demonstrations can be held without any problem. And that when you do things like what Dr. Chisabese did by going on the road, blocking traffic with supporters running after him and all that, it disrupts business activities and creates chaos and problems. Why wouldn't he go to such places which will not necessarily affect the day-to-day running of the capital city, Kampala?
That's not correct. Kasangati is nearly 10 kilometers outside Kampala. The activities in Kasangati on the main road from Gayaza to Kampala, actually on a road, a sub-road which leads to his home, does in no way affect even traffic. You should know that even if today you want to demonstrate in the National Stadium, Namboole, all in that very open ground, Kololo, you're talking about, that event would not be allowed as long as it is from a pro-democracy, pro-change-seeking institutional formation. In America, you are free even to organize a demonstration around with the White House. You are free to organize a demonstration around a Capitol Hill. Why would the American security and police not say that this is disrupting the work or traffic or something like that? So I think all these largely acts by dictatorial regimes and those regimes which abuse power, which abuse human rights, which abuse democratic rights, they use to curtail freedom and to curtail free expression
of alternative views at the premier.
Michael Mabike is the general secretary of the Red Card Front. He spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clotty, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, Malawi continues to register an increase in the number of cholera cases since an outbreak began in January. For VOA, Lamek Masina reports from the commercial capital Blantyre, plans are underway to start administering the cholera vaccine in the affected southern districts.
According to a daily update released Thursday by the Ministry of Health, Malawi has now registered more than 200 cholera cases with 7 deaths and 26 hospital admissions. The update says the outbreak that started in one district in Sanje in January has now spread to 4 others in southern Malawi, Neno, Chikwawa, Machinga and Blantyre. Records show that as of Thursday, Nsanje has 97 registered cases, Blantyre has 53, followed by Neno with 38, Chikwawa with 12, and Machinga with 2. Wongani Mbali is deputy spokesperson for the district health office in Blantyre. He blames the outbreak on poor sanitation.
According to what we have gathered, it seems that a lot of people are using unprotected wells, which are the source of infections. The water is contaminated. So as a district, we think that the cause is the use of contaminated water.
Cholera is an acute diarrheal infection caused by ingesting food or water contaminated with bacteria. The disease affects both children and adults if untreated, and it can kill within hours. To contain the outbreak, Malawi's government has announced plans to start administering the cholera vaccine this month in all the affected districts. Health Ministry spokesperson Adrian Chikumbe told a local newspaper that the government has 2.9 million doses of vaccine to be administered orally starting from May 23. Mbale of the Blantyre Health Office says his office has started taking measures to combat the vaccine hesitancy that hindered the rollout of the COVID-19 vaccine.
Starting from next week, Monday, we're having some briefings to health workers to train HSS on how they can implement this activity. After that, we'll have orientations or sensitization meetings with the community so that they can receive the vaccine without any doubt. As you know, that the majority are fearing the vaccine, saying that maybe it's for COVID.
George Job is the executive director for a health rights organization, the Malawi Health Equity Network. He says cholera vaccine aside, there is a need for the government to address sanitation problems in many rural areas in Malawi.
In Neno, for example, water has been a challenge. There was a time when Neno suffered from typhoid fever because of water. And we also understand the places that have been affected are relying on the Lisungwi River. In this case, there's need for clean water to be made available, even in hard-to-reach rural areas.
The government says it is distributing chlorine in affected areas for water treatment, as well as sending out cholera control information to people through various channels of communication. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
And right now it's time for music from our African collection.
Fancy. I don't like another man on your timetable. I don't like it, even the homies you running with, you calling your friends. I don't like the way you're getting high without me. I dislike it. You rolling with the wrong ones, you looking funny. Whoa, 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 yeah. You're a blessing from the highest, I can guarantee. Keep it private on the regular, is what you need. Step out the hot box and dance for me. Shake off the boobies with your Nancy. No, go go, Susan, and Yakaba, Baroloki. Anytime you show, I go Hinduka. Anytime you touch me, I lose control. No, go go, Susan, and Yakuka, Gache, baby. In any case, there is a Kunyakundira. In any case, tonight, pretty dangerous. Riding everybody. Serious, but I know you're super high, moving through you. Your cup's so full with the jetty on the rocks tonight. Give you about an hour and you're by my side. Would I take a thought? Talk to me. Mazi misi novana sukori. I need a delay, I need you around me. Come to think about it, you're the reason I've been empty. You're a blessing from the highest, I can guarantee. Keep it private on the regular, is what you need. Step out the hot box and dance for me. Check off the cool piece of the Nancy. No, go go, Susan, and Yakaba, Baroloki. Anytime you show, I go Hinduka. Anytime you touch me, I lose control. No, go go, Susan, and Yakuka, Gache, baby. In any case, there is a Kunyakundira. In any case, tonight, pretty dangerous. We violent everybody.
jajila lemwa badon regela garlena lena jajila lemwa badon regela shampoo po garichas ay to life garichas ay to pillow garichas ay to shampoo po garichas
immune system in the garden system.
Shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up, shut up. choro, choro, jara, choro. Never leave me when I need you by my side. Omo, wa, ja, soko. When you can, oh, when you can, oh, omo, wa, ja, soko. Me, I go love you all day, love you all night, all the time, yeah, yeah, yeah. Climb on it, see that skin smooth with it, put design on it. Wow, wine, baby girl, I know you wanna deep ride on it. Every night she says she just wants to climb on it, see that skin smooth with it, put design on it. Wow, daughter, I'm a daughter one time. I saw you there, I'm a daughter two times, two times.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, including producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, quarrels end, but words once spoken never die. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.